Hi there, welcome to The Front Page. I'm your host, Racing Post editor Tom Kerr. And you surely know the drill by now. Over the next 30 minutes, I and two of my esteemed colleagues will be chewing over three of the biggest stories in the racing world from the last week. And joining me today in the studio is none other than John Harding, Front Page Tom. Regular. Thanks so much for joining us, John. And remotely from Ireland, Deputy Ireland Editor David Jennings. Thanks for joining, David.
Pleasure, Tom.
Before we dive in, I must contractually obliged, in fact, to say you should please like, comment, subscribe and share. But with that out of the way, we're going to dive straight in. And DJ, you're going to take us away this week. What's been catching your eye over the last 7 days?
So, yes, Tom, it's been the long-running season saga of Honeysuckle and where she's going to end up at the 2023 Cheltenham Festival. And we now know that if she is to run at the Cheltenham Festival next month, it is going to be in the Clough Brothers Mayor's Hurdle rather than the Unibet Champion Hurdle, which has irked a lot of people, not least one of my favourite pundit in racing, Steve Mellish, and possibly not my favourite pundit in racing, Matt Chapman, who both agreed that Honeysuckle should be running in the Champion Hurdle. And look, I can see their point. It is an utter disgrace, probably, that the last three winners of the Champion Hurdle are not going to be running in the race this year, namely Honeysuckle Twice and Epitod. But the fact of the matter is, and my point is, we can, you know, look back and romanticise all we want, but the world has moved on and the Cheltenham Festival has moved on, and Honeysuckle's best chance of winning a race at the 2023 Cheltenham Festival is in the Mayor's Hurdle, and it would be a glorious occasion, I think, personally, if she were to win the race. Look, it's not ideal. I would love, and I'm sure you would too, and so would Jonathan, for the Cheltenham Festival to be 3 days. There would be nothing I would love more. There would be nothing I would love more for there to be no Mayor's Hurdle. And for all the great mayors to be running in the Champion Hurdle, the Gold Cup, the Ryanair, or wherever they have to go, and not run against their own sex. But that's not going to happen. It's moved on, the Cheltenham Festival. We have to get up and get on with it and stop saying that these mayors should be running elsewhere, because their trainers are going to find the races that they have the best chance of winning. That's what Henry de Bromhead is doing. And I think personally, if there was no Mayor's Hurdle, I think Honeysuckle would be retired now. So it's probably not the end of the world that she is running the Mayor's Hurdle, because it might have been the end of Honeysuckle if there was no Mayor's Hurdle, which obviously Matt and Steve Mellish disagree. But I think they're doing the right thing, Tom, running her in the Mayor's Hurdle.
Is it not a bit like, though, DJ, a football team which supposedly had the option of playing the Champions League or the Europa League, saying, let's go in the Europa League because that's our best chance of winning?
That's a good analogy, but I don't think so. I think it's different. I think what you've got here is a mare who has won two Champion Hurdles, and she has reached the very top. She's been at the top, and she is not as good as she was. It would be fine if the team in question had qualified for the Champions League and they said, no, we're not good enough. But if they've qualified for the Champions League, they're obviously playing well, they're obviously doing well, they're obviously thinking they can go far in the Champions League. Kenny Alexander and Henry de Bromhead know well the Honeysuckle has no chance of winning the Champion Hurdle. At best, she's going to finish third. Like, she's not going to be Constitution Hill, and they know now that Stateman, at the moment, is a better and more talented horse than Honeysuckle. So what they're saying to themselves is, it will be a glorious way for Honeysuckle to bow out by winning the Mayor's Hurdle. And while I accept your point on the Europa League, Champions League, I don't think Honeysuckle is at her peak at the minute. Her Racing Post rating in the Irish Champion Hurdle suggests that too. She's just not as good as she was, Tom. And there are people who will say she is every bit as good as she was, and she was never any good in the first place. But I disagree.
Let's talk more Cheltenham. Another running saga of the season is just Willie Mullins dominating everything. I was looking today, he's got another supreme candidate. He could have four of the first five in the market for the festival opener. It's extraordinary, isn't it, DJ?
Absolutely extraordinary. Last time I looked, it keeps changing. It's hovering somewhere between 12 and 14 favourites for the last kind of fortnight for the Cheltenham Festival, which is extraordinary, really. And I did a column on this a few weeks ago. The real, real, real scary thing is that not only does he have favourites in these races, if he has between 12 and 14 favourites, he also has so much backup. Like, you go to the Dublin Racing Festival, like, if you were told before that weekend began that Lossiemouth, Appreciated, Blue Lord and Facile Vega would all be beaten, you would have said, oh God, that's an awful weekend for Willie Mullins. There's going to be an internal investigation in Cloyne Sutton into what happened at the Dublin Racing Festival. But lo and behold, Gala Marceau, El Fabiolo, Gentleman to Me and LFA Tom come out and win, along with Galloping the Champs and State Man. So it's this strength and depth, Tom, that's incredible, really. And, you know, even yesterday, Hunter's Yarn, who is not a real sexy horse, nobody was really talking about him, comes out and absolutely bolts up in a race that included American Mike and Imagine, who had solid form. I think if there are blowouts among his favourites, there are second, third and fourth strings that could easily mop up the scraps that are left behind. And that's why I think he is going to have more winners than he had last year. He had 10 last year. I think it's roughly in around evens, each of two, whether he has 11 or more winners or 10 or less. I'd nearly be going over, Tom. Not because I think all his favourites are good things. It's because of the B team. And I think the B team is really strong this year.
I mean, the C team and D team is looking pretty strong as well. But one race which is fairly open, or fairly open by the standards of this year's festival, is the Stayers. We had a great comeback from Blazing Cow yesterday.
Absolutely, yeah. And for a race that everybody's been saying all season didn't really capture the imagination. Like, there was a lot of trainers thinking, God, I might run in that because of a chance of winning, you know, with outsiders that maybe mightn't be, you know, champion hurdle standard of that or that. Now you've got Blazing Cal and Tihupu. And the thing about those are, like, they're kind of unexposed, younger horses. I know Blazing Cal obviously is not that young because he missed a season through injury, but they're unexposed. We don't know how good they are. And they're currently 5-2 joint favourites with the sponsors of the race, Paddy Power. So this race has really kind of started to look like we used to look at the Stayers Hurdle. Like, obviously Barracuda unfortunately passed away at the age of 28 during the weekend. You know, I remember back to those Barracuda, Irish Escape, Limestone Lad days, and those were glorious days. And I don't think the Stayers Hurdle is ever going to reach that level again, because there seems to be a real incentive to go chasing now with the better novices. But this year, if you've got the two-time winner of the race, Flooring Porter, against Tihupu, and obviously against Blazing Cal, a terrific training achievement by Charles Burns yesterday. If those three turn up at the peak of their powers, it's going to be a cracking race.
John, we had some Cheltenham clues in Britain as well, but perhaps indicative of the way the season's gone, perhaps the most intriguing of them was a two-runner race.
Yeah, I mean, match race is usually my opportunity if I'm watching at home to go and make a cup of tea, because I have zero interest in watching two horses.
You better say tobacco, innit?
Two horses jumping around next to each other in a, they're just silly races. But obviously this is John Bond, this is the, well, was the Arkell favourite, now slightly pushed out, I think, after what was not the most, it wasn't the most captivating win from him. But again, I stress it was a silly race. It's a two-horse race. The outsiders made it an odd test by just kicking on around the bend and making it John Bond having to think. If I was on John Bond for the Arkell, I still wouldn't be too worried. I don't think we learnt anything. I also don't think we hugely... I didn't watch it and think he's no longer the Arkell winner. I just think it was he was a victim of circumstance there. I'd have liked for him to have a bigger test given what's waiting for him at Cheltenham. But yeah, it was just an odd race won by a very good horse.
Yeah. And where do you stand on the honeysuckle debate?
It's difficult, and it's a wonderful, well-worn cliche of head v heart, isn't it? But I mean, the head says the whole point of racing is find winnable races for your horse. Kenny Alexander and Henry de Bromhead aren't stupid. This is the most winnable race. But I personally think, being a romantic as I am, that she should be running in the Champion Hurdle.
There's a lot of on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, and there's a lot of pressure now, isn't there? You know, if she doesn't win the Mayor's Hurdle, that's going to be incredibly deflating now if she places in that. I'd rather she place in a Champion Hurdle than in a Mayor's Hurdle.
Is it going to be incredibly deflating? Like, is it? Like, I know everybody is saying, oh, it's a shame if she goes out, like, after either finishing third or fourth in a Champion Hurdle or being beaten in the Mayor's Hurdle. But she won 16 races in a row. She won two Champion Hurdles. Just because she's not winning Champion Hurdles now, it doesn't mean she was a great in the, she wasn't a great in the past. I don't know. I think she's just not as good as she was, but I don't think that should take away from her career if she's beaten in a Mayor's Hurdle. And I actually don't think she'd win the race either.
No, I don't think it would take away. We're not talking so much about the back catalogue. I just mean on the day. You know, as a final swan song, I would be... a lot of the talk now is, okay, well, if you're not going to run in the Champion Hurdle, then you better go win the Mares. I think there is an almost more pressure now running in the Mares in some ways. There is a little bit of she is now expected to win, whereas if she ran in the Champion Hurdle, there's the weight's slightly off. It's more of a celebration, maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to find rationale for running her in the Champion Hurdle because I want her to go there, but I understand the logic. I think it's a logical decision. But
DJ, what price would you make Honeysuckle in the champion hurdle?
Well, I think straight after the race, she was 20-1. I think she's definitely a 20-1 chance. Like, put it this way, she mightn't be 20-1 because firms will be afraid to risk the each way part of that bet because it looks a two horse race between Stateman and Constitution Hill. You might only have five runners on the day, and you're talking about Vauban, Sharjah, and Honeysuckle maybe fighting it out for third. But 20-1 shot for a champion hurdle, 7-4 favour for a mare's hurdle. It's a no-brainer to me. And just for the record, I know we're going to move on now. I would dearly love her to run the champion hurdle. There would be nothing I would love more to Cheltenham Festival than for Honeysuckle to run in the champion hurdle. But unfortunately, the world has moved on, Tom.
The world has moved on. And in one of the seamless segues for which I'm famous, we're now going to move on to another way the world has moved on, which is we can talk about betting, but can we actually bet? Affordability checks. Regular viewers of this show know that we've been covering this subject extensively. And there's been more developments in the last week, John. So first of all, where do we start? Let's start with the gambling minister, Paul Scully. He'd come in less than 4 months ago, seemed to inject some common sense into proceedings, said the other week they gave an unequivocal statement that the government, the regulator, have no place determining how much people can afford to bet. And then he's gone. Then he's gone. He's disappeared after less than 4 months in the job. And we're going to get another gambling minister. I think it will be the sixth with responsibility for gambling since the gambling review was announced. Paul Scully's boss, the culture minister, has also moved on. We've had 12 of them in 13 years. And I think it's fair to say that these ministers, when they come in, weren't exactly subject matter experts. So given the bewildering level of turnover, it's perhaps no surprise that the gambling review is a mess that we've been waiting for years, and that into this vacuum, an absence of political leadership, the Gambling Commission has stepped in, the UK regulator, to drive forward its own policies and agendas around safer gambling. One of the big themes, of course, has been that the Gambling Commission has introduced affordability checks, or the bookmakers have introduced it under Gambling Commission pressure. However, we then had the Commission's chief executive, Andrew Rhodes, quoted in Sunday's newspaper saying that the introduction of affordability checks was nothing to do with the regulator. He said, and I quote, "We do not require operators to get payslips or bank statements. It will be up to the operator how they go about any check they feel they need to make." It has to be said, this is like either totally disingenuous or betrays just how little the Gambling Commission actually understands what it's doing, because the Gambling Commission requires bookmakers to consider the financial circumstances of their customers when determining risk, and the only way a bookmaker can consider financial circumstances is to conduct an affordability check. So we're now basically being gaslit by the regulator. There's no one in government that currently has responsibility for gambling, and when they do appoint someone, we can assume that their tenure is going to be less than the average Southampton manager. Mm-hmm. What a mess.
Yes, what a mess. And every market needs... The job of the regulator is to ensure that the market is working as it should, and all that we have at the moment is just the uncertainty is driving all of this. That's the key word. We have a lack of transparency from the government on what precisely it wants the regulator to do, what measures need to be put in place by the regulator, and we've got a regulator operating in that grey area, guessing at it, and therefore bookmakers are also guessing at it and haphazardly bringing in these checks. It is a little bit disingenuous what he's saying. I think it's right in the sense, from the conversations I've had, that the Gambling Commission isn't saying you need to bring in affordability checks, but it is saying it by not saying it, if you see what I mean. It's creating a de facto environment whereby the bookmakers are having to guess at what is described as proportionate thresholds. Mm. So the Gambling Commission requires operators to have proportionate thresholds. If somebody is hitting one of those markers of harm, bring in affordability checks to make sure they're protected. Nobody's disagreeing with that. The problem is, where do we set that bar? And the Gambling Commission sets that bar far lower than you'd imagine.
The Gambling Commission haven't actually explicitly set
a
threshold. So therefore, bookmakers basically are left in the situation that they don't know what will be frowned upon if they later have found not to intervene to where the Gambling Commission thinks they should have intervened. Yeah. And therefore, inevitably, the Gambling Commission, the bookmakers are effectively taking a precautionary approach and saying, well, we're going to introduce these affordability checks quite extensively. And we had an RMG survey that came out today that suggested around 1 in 5 of their subscribers have already been asked for personal information, such as payslips, by their bookmakers. So it's scooping up a lot of people. And I think we can assume it's going to scoop up even more people when events like the Cheltenham Festival come around and people are betting at a slightly higher level than they might do through the rest of the season.
No, you're right. And the bookmakers are taking their cue off, I believe, two things. They're taking their cue off the Gambling Commission's general attitude. And from the conversations I've had, that is one not of engaging with the bookmaking industry, but of a very public health leaning. We're setting the bar for gambling harm fairly low. I think they'd list reduced cinema attendance as one of the markers that you might have an unhealthy relationship with gambling. It's very cautious from the Gambling Commission. That, coupled with these big headline multi-million pound fines for breaching what are essentially very vague rules, mean that the bookmakers are walking on eggshells almost constantly, which is why they're bringing them in at lower levels than you might imagine. I think that's what you're saying. That's why the gambling minister and all the change in government is so important, because you need somebody to come in and get a hold of the situation and say, legislatively, this is what you should be doing. This is your remit as the regulator. It is not to put this pressure on. It's not to. You have three licensing objectives: to make sure gambling is conducted in a fair and open way, to protect children and vulnerable people. These are all things that bookmakers would want as well, and to avoid, make sure we haven't got money laundering and things like that. The job of the regulator is to regulate, not to create an environment whereby bookmakers are having to guess and having to take cues. And there just needs transparency across the board. There needs to be some sort of directive of, this is the level.
Clarity is what is.
That's all it is, yeah. And I know that's a real vague thing to say, but ultimately that is. Mm. The Gambling Commission would welcome some, I'm sure, but bookmakers need to know where the goalposts are, and they don't at the moment.
Yeah, and when the Gambling Commission are basically denying any responsibility for creating this situation, then we know we're very unlikely to get that clarity from the regulator. So it defaults to the politicians, but we don't have any politicians in office. So not a great situation. DJ, Ireland sometimes ends up being the collateral damage of wayward British policymaking, whether it's Brexit, white fences, whip rules, etc., etc. This is happening with affordability checks though as well, isn't it? Because Irish customers of British bookmakers are also getting caught up in these checks.
Absolutely, getting caught in the crossfire. Yeah, it's amazing watching from afar, seeing what's going on, because it just seems to me that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And the key word for me would be stability. There's no stability whatsoever anywhere. As Jonathan said there, and as you said as well, like it can't be, you know, one rule for everybody. It can't be. It's far more complex than that. Like there are different types of gamblers, and there are different types of ways of doing things, and we can't just go one fell swoop and say this is the way we do things. You know, there needs to be a proper and stable team put in place to figure out the best way of dealing with this, because we all want the best outcome out of this horrific scenario. And I think stability is definitely the key to that. We need to get some stability over there, Tom, and I'm sure both of you will agree. When that's the first thing that needs to happen. We can't have all these changes all the time. We need to get a team in place that's going to be able to cope with this mess.
Stability is not something commonly associated with British politics these days, unfortunately. Just before we move on from this this depressing chocolate gâteau with the cherry on top of it, which was the BHA chair, Joe Saunders-Smith, giving a speech last week, in which he warned that unless the sport sort of tackled some of its issues, that it addressed some of the welfare concerns of younger generations, it might not exist in 30 years.
Yeah, that was quite a striking line from him, fairly unprompted, and it made us obviously stand up and pay attention. There is a there's a sense occasionally I feel that British racing can be a little bit scared of its own shadow. I'm of the view that we need to be very conscious of these things. So it's heartening to me to hear the BHHR come out and say, we're aware that the views of under 35s are changing. We're aware of this social license. We know that people have a different view of animals in Britain. Now that's changing how we don't, the use of animals in sport is going to become a topic of debate. But at the same time, it occasionally needs to just dig its heels in and stand its ground. I think there's a balance to be struck of being conscious of changing attitudes, being proactive, being willing to change, while also not conceding ground unnecessarily. Mm. So I'd like to see British Racing say, okay, we're aware of these views, we're going to take it to the, as he said, you know, we need to communicate it, but he almost needs to add a second part of that where it's, but we're not going to please everyone and this is where our line in the sand is and we're not going to move past it on certain issues. I don't know. I think if you're too conscious of the outside, you can kind of forget to stand up for what is actually a legitimate sport. Occasionally it feels like it's illegitimate and it's just worried that it's going to die any second. And it's a bit, you just need a little bit more. I don't know. I don't want to use stability again.
The stability episode. It is about balance. So again, it's about being conscious of these sort of societal forces, which are real.
Yes, yeah. But
not being terrified of your own shadow. Easy to say, harder to actually determine what that ought to look like. Because clearly it can't just be, you know, la, 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 we can't hear any critics. It cannot be,
we'll change anything. Yeah.
You need to plot a sensible route through these challenges. And we've seen time and time again just how difficult that can be.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've touched on it there. I've always found that view, as a quote-unquote young person in racing, that sort of, you know, it's that classic go and watch Peppa Pig line. You know, I don't think it's a case of hunkering down and saying we're going to carry on exactly how we want to, sod everyone else, because that's not, that there's no sport is in a privileged position where it's able to do exactly what it wants all the time. You have to be conscious of the way the world is changing. But like you say, you also need to do that in a productive way that doesn't concede so much ground that you're essentially pedaling backwards. You need to find the way of doing it. And that's where the long-term strategy, the fabled long-term strategy and all this collaboration that we've spoken about is going to come in and everything's going to be rosy and we're going to navigate all these choppy waters. I sincerely hope, in practice, I'm not entirely sure, but there needs to be a joined-up approach because these issues, the whip, perception, welfare, reaching out to politicians, they are all interlinked and they need to be handled as one.
And also just the popularity of the sport as well. Yes. So, you know, how do we structure the season? How do we present our biggest events? How do we draw new fans in and make it engaging and captivating for new audiences as well as old audiences? It's not just about, you know, what do we need to change to protect the sport? It's also about how do we make the sport as appealing as possible? Yeah. One thing which does still appeal to a lot of people, the Grand National. John,
another lovely segue.
Thank you.
Yeah, so this is the Grand National. This is sadly another tricky story for British racing, and I think it comes in two parts. So we had the Grand National entries come out. There was 85 of them. The first point to say is that 31 of them were by British trainers, which in itself is concerning, not enough to make a full field. Versus, I think, Mullins, who we've spoken about, and Gordon Elliott had 29 between them, and 54 of the 85 were, I think that math works out, 54 were Irish trained. That speaks to a few things. I mean, it's a race that, due to the qualification criteria, it requires a certain type of horse. I think it requires a slightly classier horse. We know where the classy horses are over those extreme trips. They're mostly in Ireland, so I think there is a degree of maybe the British trainers, perhaps if they don't have a horse for the race, they don't have a horse for the race. I know Paul Nicholls came out and said this, I would run one, but I don't, that's not where our focus is. So that's one point, but it is concerning. Britain's biggest race in theory, certainly in the public consciousness, isn't going to have that many British runners in it. And we're going to see a lot of horses representing a few yards, and we're going to see a lot of Irish influence, which is no bad thing, but also you'd like to see it somewhere near 50-50. The second thing that comes from that is that qualification criteria. Now, they've tightened that up, I think, quite rightly. A few people are going to disagree. It's not the race it used to be. We want 100-foot fences. It's gone soft, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, generally, they're broadly well-received. But at the same time, you get these anomalies, and we have one in I Will Do It, a Welsh Grand National and Classic Chase winner who can't run in the race because he didn't have six runs over fences by a fairly arbitrary date in February. And obviously that's been picked up by some people as it's ridiculous. If he can't run in it, who can? I'm slightly more, I try to take a slightly balanced view to this in that ultimately the connections knew what the rules were, they knew what the qualification criteria is, and they didn't hit them. That's their fault. But at the same time, I think it is possible that they need to be looked at, because you can't have a situation where a Welsh Grand National winner can't run at Aintree. It's odd. There needs to be tweaks. There needs to be something.
There's a letter in today's paper suggesting a wild card system, you know, on the similar lines to sort of Wimbledon, for example.
Yeah.
If there's an obvious standout candidate like I Will Do It, who you cannot possibly have any question marks around their ability to be competitive in their race and their safety in the race, you know, there should be a mechanism by which they can be drafted into the race, which I think makes a lot of sense, and also actually, you know, adds a bit of intrigue to things.
Yeah, that is a good idea. And I think they've quite rightly made it a little bit harder to get into the race because it needed to improve its safety record. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. It is a safer race than it was. You need experienced chasers. You need, you know, we have all the veterinary procedures that have been updated. It needs to be the right horses lining up on the day. But you are always going to get these anomalies. And a horse like I Will Do It slipping through the net suggests to me that they maybe do need to look at the qualification criteria, because he should be there. But also, I am slightly of the view that actually that they knew that what needed to be done to qualify him, and they didn't do it. It wasn't entirely their fault because the ground went at Newbury, but
yeah,
you know,
you've got to take some responsibility.
You've got to say, and to be fair to the owner of I Will Do It, did take a very considered view of, let's have a look at the qualification, but also it's just one of those things. And
yeah. DJ, well, I mean, let's not beat around the bush. 31 British entries for the Grand National. It's pathetic.
Yeah, pathetic is probably the best way to describe it. Incredible to think, like, it's, you know, 2 months to the race and there's only 31 possible home runners in the race. Like, absolutely extraordinary. I spoke to Ted Walsh about this and many other things Grand National related last week for a story. And look, Ted is great. Ted is old school. We know that. And the thing I love about Ted Walsh, Mr. Peppa Pig himself, is that what's in his head just comes straight through and out of his mouth. And in this modern era of watching your P's and Q's, it is absolutely refreshing to hear somebody actually say what they think rather than what they think they're supposed to think. So it was great. Look, his point is basically that it's a great race with a rich history and that you shouldn't have to jump through so many hoops to get a runner in the race. Like, as he points out, Statler has to run again in the Gold Cup to qualify for the race. I Will Do It, who won the Welsh National, like a proper test of a staying chaser, can't run in the Grand National. There's been letters sent out to potential runners in the race saying what they have to do to run in the race. And he just can't understand all the hoops that have to be jumped through to get to the actual race. Never mind jumping all the fences when you get there, jumping the fences to actually get to jump the fences. So it was interesting to hear all his points. And I see Jonathan's point as well. Like, you know, you can't just say, let's keep the race the way it was, you know, when Red Rome was winning and Crisp and those great days. And, you know, you have to make changes and you have to alter to accommodate your audience. Maybe it's gone too far, though. Maybe it has gone a little bit too far. Maybe there's a happy medium to be met somewhere. I like the wildcard idea, although the wildcard idea has the potential to cause absolute ructions, because I don't know how you would quantify who would qualify for the wildcard and who would not, or who would be in charge of deciding who is the wildcard, whether it would be Martin Greenwood or somebody, I don't know. But it would be fascinating, because it does create debate, this wildcard thing. Like, if you think of the Premier League darts and stuff, like, that caused ructions, but people have to get up and get on with it and you just accept it. So whoever wrote that letter, that's a quite interesting point. But look, the Grand National is still going to be a great race. It's not the test it was, and I often have chats with our Ireland editor, Richie Forrestal, about this and how it's not the real jumping test that it used to be. And the proof of that is, of course, a novice winning the race last year, Noble Yeats. And I think that's what you're going to see more of going forward. And maybe that's one of the reasons they're trying to have the qualification process where you have to have a certain amount of runs over fences to run the race. You're going to have a lot more novices trying to get into the race, because in general, you only get one. Maybe Andy second now is a rarity in that he's going to have three shots at it now. But you only really get one proper shot to win a Grand National where you're going to be well handicapped on the day to win that race and you're improving. So, yeah, my chat with Ted was very interesting, Tom, as it always is.
I think I need to give credit now to Pat Wood, who wrote the letter in question. Great suggestion. You're getting rave reviews on here, Pat. I think you'd want people like Ted Walsh sitting on the wildcard committee, wouldn't you? But, and it would actually become a sort of a fascinating stage in the path to the Grand National, because you know they put out their decisions. And it would cause huge debate, which is ultimately what we want about the sport.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah, Ted. Yeah, you want cameras on that. You want a live stream of that committee with Ted on it. But look, Ted is Ted, and there'll never be another Ted. And sometimes in life, you just have to admire somebody like Ted Walsh, because if I had half the balls that Ted Walsh has, I'd be over the moon, to be honest with you. He's a character.
Fantastic. Well, let's leave it on a happier note for once. John, so I need to now determine which of these three stories is going to go on the front page. Massive stories, but I'm going to give it to the National because it is the greatest horse race in the world, I'd say. You've still got 9 million people watching it. But also, it's tapping into this long-running theme of weakness in the top level of British jumping. And a pretty worrying sign of the times if we can't even get a full Grand National field from Britain. So that's on the front page. Congratulations, John.
Thank you. And all will be forgiven if there's a British 1, 2, 3, 4.
Absolutely.
But we live in hope.
If we get four runners.
Yes.
I am now going to tell you, or in fact, I'm going to introduce a very special members club offer. We've got a special deal running and you're going to learn about it now.
Racing Post Members Club is the ultimate racing subscription, and new customers can give it a try with 50% off your first 3 months. A subscription includes unlimited access to the Racing Post digital newspaper, available from 9 p.m. the evening before it's out in shops. Plus there are daily write-ups from our tipsters, replays from all UK and Irish racecourses, and plenty more exclusive online content. Click the link in the audio description to learn more and get 50% off your first 3 months.
Okay, that's everything for this week. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks very much to my guests today, John Harding in the studio and David Jennings from Ireland. That's it. Please come back next week where we'll have more debate about all the big issues in racing. But till then, goodbye.